Europe is experiencing the largest wave of refugees since World War II and is desperate to find a long-term solution. Join America Abroad for a town hall discussion linking New York to Berlin on iTunes and PRI.org/AmericaAbroad.
China's middle class demands clean air. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. China has been spewing much more carbon dioxide into the air than we knew, and the pressure for China to clean up its act is growing both outside the country and in.
There's a growing middle class that's also saying very vociferously, we don't want to have to breathe this stuff in. Stop it.
Also, the presidents of China and Taiwan plan to meet for the first time in over six decades. Here's what one Taiwanese American makes of that.
On the one hand, I think it's a good step forward, and on the other hand, it feels sort of like, wait, this hasn't happened yet?
Plus, a trend in Sweden toward a six-hour workday, to which this Swedish career coach says,
what will we do with the rest of the time?
Those stories coming up today on The World.
The World is brought to you by Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're going to start off the show today talking about China. There is word today that the leaders of China and Taiwan are going to meet, something that hasn't happened since never, actually. We'll hear a personal take on that tantalizing news in just a few minutes. But first, another report out of China today that China probably is not thrilled to publicize. It turns out that the world's largest emitter of carbon dioxide has been emitting a whole lot more than anyone ever realized. Mary Kay Magstad was the world's Beijing correspondent for years. We asked her what she made of the fact that China now says it's burning 17% more coal than previously reported.
Over 15 years of covering China, one thing that became clear to me is that statistics in China are unreliable in many cases. So does it surprise me? Yes, to some extent. But does it surprise me that between 2000 and 2013, China's actual growth was higher than the target? So that coal use would have been higher as well. Kind of makes sense. It's also interesting, though, that over the last couple of years, coal use has started to decline. And that's partly because of an economic slowdown, but it's also because the government has been leaning more heavily on local factories and power plants to actually use coal scrubbers, use more high-quality coal, and move in the right direction.
So do you think the Chinese government was actually covering up and lying about coal emissions, or was this just some kind of error?
The new numbers come from the Chinese government. They come from the National Bureau of Statistics and were released in the Chinese Statistical Yearbook. So I think it's probably more that the current administration, in its process of becoming more serious about cutting down on coal emissions and greenhouse gas emissions, has been looking at, okay, what are we really dealing with here? And you know, I was just in China and was talking to people who have spent their careers studying China's energy use. And what I was hearing both from Chinese analysts and Western analysts was, you know, they are moving in the right direction now. China is trying to increase its use of renewable energy and reduce its coal use. And over time, certainly in the next decade, decade and a half, it's expected that coal use will peak and start to come down. Xi Jinping has pledged that this will happen by 2030, but in fact, by many estimates right now, it could happen a lot sooner.
So tell us what that actually looks like and feels like and smells like, because a couple of years ago, I clearly remember speaking with you about pollution in Beijing, and you were choking, honestly, during that interview because it was so bad there. So what is changing overall? What did you see?
The interview you're talking about was in January 2013. When because of various weather patterns, there was a lot of pollution socked into Beijing, and it was double the maximum that usually is registered on pollution monitors, which is way, 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 way above the maximum that the World Health Organization says anyone should have to breathe in. So yeah, I was choking. And there have been other days since then, and certainly before then, when pollution was bad, just not that bad. This takes a toll, no surprise, on people's health in China. Hundreds of thousands of people die prematurely each year due to causes related to pollution. And the government is starting to recognize that this is a human cost, it's an economic cost, It's a cost that China can't continue to pay as it moves forward. And as there's a growing middle class that's also saying very vociferously, we don't want to have to breathe this stuff in. Stop it.
So how does all this news taint China and, for that matter, all the proceedings at the upcoming International Climate Summit in Paris later this month into December? I mean, politically, what will it change in the negotiations, and how much bargaining power does this news deprive China of now?
A lot of people are recognizing that the Chinese government's policy has shifted and has shifted in the right direction. Despite this news, you know, they're the ones who are saying we have been dealing with a different level of emissions than we had previously reported or thought at the national level. We're now serious about moving to reduce greenhouse gases and coal use. So I think what can you do when you're negotiating? You want to do the best you can from this point forward. So I think others at the table will say, okay, so we would like to take you at your word and move forward together and make sure that we all are using less energy that causes greenhouse gas emissions.
That was The World's Mary Kay Magstead. Now, a quick test before our next story. How many Chinas are there? Well, actually, two. Don't forget Taiwan. Taiwan claims sovereignty over all China, just as Beijing claims control of Taiwan, which it calls a renegade province. But the times, they are a-changing, we think. There's been a thaw in relations for the last few years. Then just yesterday, it was announced that the leaders of the two Chinas are to hold their first summit ever. The civil war back in the 1940s between communist and nationalist China ended with millions of people fleeing to what became Taiwan. So we reached out to the daughter of one such family to get a personal take on this story. Michelle Chen is a writer and joins us from New York. Michelle, what is your gut reaction to hearing news of this historic meeting?
On the one hand, I think it's a good step forward. And on the other hand, it feels sort of like, wait, this hasn't happened yet. I thought people were doing this all the time. But when you think about how far things have come in the last 20, 30 years or so, it is pretty amazing how much things have moved forward in terms of just bridging this gap across this silly little strip of ocean called the Taiwan Strait.
New Yorkers may be familiar with your parents and the shop that they started, the Pearl River Mart in Manhattan. What are your parents saying about this summit?
Well, I talked to my dad, and he's pretty excited, though I feel like they were kind of ahead of the curve since they've been fostering cross-strait relations since, you know, before Nixon even shook hands with Nixon even did his visit to China. And I think that initial sort of handshake diplomacy, if you will, kind of opened the door for U.S.-China relations. And from there on, it was only a matter of time before the wall started to fall between China and Taiwan.
I mean, if the narrative of people fleeing to Taiwan from mainland China is complicated, your own parents' story is even more complex about how they ended up in the States ultimately. Just recap it for us real quick.
They were both born on the mainland. They left after the revolution with the Nationalist Army. They sort of, their families were split, essentially. Most of my immediate and semi-immediate relatives are residing currently in Taiwan. But when they were young, they came to the U.S. to study. And from the U.S., they sort of renewed their interest in the mainland, and they learned a lot about what was going on in China that they didn't know and didn't understand when they were growing up in Taiwan. They grew up largely when it was still a military dictatorship. So being in the U.S. and looking at China from that angle gave them a whole different perspective on what it meant to be part of the diaspora. And then they ended up starting a business that was devoted to fostering U.S.-China relations. And they always sort of saw themselves as their family background is part of an outgrowth of that longstanding tension.
Right.
And as they developed their business and sort of the barriers to trade melted away, the same thing happened in Taiwan. So it's been a pretty big 180.
Well, let's clarify that no deal has been done, and relations between China and Taiwan may not be transformed anytime soon. But this summit on Saturday is pretty symbolic, and symbols can lead to concrete stuff. Where would you like to see this all headed in kind of a blue sky world?
I grew up in a generation that no longer saw these tensions as so monumental or insurmountable. So in a sense, I think in a way, people who are younger they're kind of happy to sort of coast and watch things evolve gradually. I think people on both the mainland and in Taiwan are approaching this cautiously. I think Taiwan is in a much more wary position because it is seen as kind of, you know, dwarfed in many ways by China. And so they don't want to be, you know, sort of colonized by the mainland. But I also think that people feel ready in some ways. But if history is any guide, it's that these things can't really be pushed. And the best way they develop is really organically through people-to-people exchange and kind of just by learning more about each other. And that might actually come more naturally than we think. And I feel like in a lot of ways, the populaces of both of these countries, they kind of know what China is about in their own worlds. And they're probably a couple steps ahead of the officials.
Writer Michelle Chen in New York, thanks for speaking with us again.
Thanks.
As if things weren't hard enough for people in Yemen, Cyclone Chapala battered the Yemeni island of Socotra on Sunday, then made landfall in southern Yemen, hitting the city of Al-Mukalla. It was a huge storm. We're talking reports of 10 years' worth of rain dumping down in the space of 2 days. There's been massive flooding, and getting help to the victims of that flooding could be complicated. That's because the city of Al-Mukalla is in the grip of the Yemeni branch of Al-Qaeda. I spoke earlier with Rima Kamal. She's with the International Committee of the Red Cross in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. First of all, Rima, tell us about conditions in Al-Mukalla today.
The southern city of Mukalla has experienced very high sea waves reaching up to 10 meters high. There has been floods, there has been heavy rains and storms as well, gushing winds. So a lot of people who are living on the coastal areas have had to be evacuated. A lot of homes are now standing either fully or partially destroyed.
Have there been any fatalities?
There has been a number of people injured in the island of Socotra and also 3 reported and confirmed cases of death. This has primarily been in Socotra. So far, we have not received reports about additional casualties, but those could still be coming in.
I mean, I was hearing reports about 22-foot waves hitting the city of Al-Mukalla, a flood of biblical proportions. How prepared is a city like this for an event like a cyclone, especially when it is so rare?
Not the least prepared, and exactly because it is so rare, certain measures have been put in place, but the infrastructure is not built to handle floods even or heavy rains. This is usually a very arid area that's very dry. People are not used to this. People are not prepared either to cope and deal with this.
So how has the presence of Al-Qaeda in Al-Mukalla actually complicated the relief operation?
To be honest, it has not complicated it. What has complicated the relief operation is primarily the damages that we have seen in the area. So insecurity as such has not been the main challenge, but rather the damage that has been inflicted on the infrastructure. So the coastal areas are, for example, heavily flooded. Communication networks have been down. So those have actually been the main challenges facing relief organizations trying to reach people affected in Mukalla.
Rima, what is the biggest challenge you and the ICRC are facing in the wake of Cyclone Chapala?
One of the biggest challenges is that we would like to shift the focus again to the larger conflict that is ongoing in Yemen. And of course, it is important to focus on the suffering and the damages that have been caused by the cyclone. But at the end of the day, 3 people died from Cyclone Chapala. You have 30 people dying in Yemen every day because of lack of access to healthcare services, because of various war wounds, because of the airstrikes as well. So it's important to look at the bigger picture. Yes, the cyclone was extremely unfortunate and has hit Yemen hard, but it has been passing and it will end. But then you have the larger conflict that is ongoing, which at this point in time does not seem to have an end in sight, and which is the primary reason and cause of the suffering of the Yemeni people.
Rima Kamal with the ICRC in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
A BBC correspondent stayed through the Lebanese civil war as a child, and now she thinks a lot about Syrians leaving their home. Later here on The World.
Support for The World comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like decluttering, drone photography, and duct tape crafting. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. At the last Republican debate, Jeb Bush stuck it to Marco Rubio for failing to show up for votes in the U.S. Senate.
You should be showing up to work. I mean, literally, the Senate, what is it, like a French work week? You get like 3 days where you have to show up?
The French work week line did not go down well across the pond. Bush apologized, saying he had done a disservice to the French. But actually, some local governments in France do think they have a problem with the number of times their workers call in sick. My BBC colleague Lucy Williamson headed to the Paris suburb of Bondy to see who was showing up for work.
We're out here with the early morning street cleaners because this summer, Bondy became the latest French council to offer its workers a bonus of 50 euros a month if they manage to turn up every day for work.
Ah, here's someone now. Bonjour.
It turns out to be Céline de Roule, arriving promptly at 9 o'clock for her job in the council's cultural department.
I'm not well myself, actually. I've got back problems, but I'm coming into work anyway. I worry that being absent would mean losing money, which I can't afford because my husband is unemployed and I've got 2 children.
Since the town hall introduced the scheme this summer, sick leave has dropped by 49%. But Céline says it isn't all down to the promise of a 50 euro bonus. Because there's a stick as well as a carrot embedded in this scheme. If you're off sick for more than 8 days a year, your salary is cut. So long to the stereotype of France's overprotected civil service.
Well, the town hall's just opened for business this morning, and so we've popped inside to talk to the mayor, Sylvine Thomassin, about this new scheme.
The mayor is a die-hard leftist, but she says France's sluggish economy is forcing her to make some tough choices.
L'absentéisme à Bondy, c'est 4 millions d'euros dans mon budget.
Absenteeism cost me 4 million euros each year. I'm the mayor of a working-class town, and the people finance us with their taxes. It's not acceptable. I don't want to penalize people for being ill, but I also have to listen to my employees, who say they suffer from the high number of absences by their colleagues. There was a lot of support for the union here when it said the absences had to stop.
But how do you tell the difference between someone who's faking and someone who's, well, puking? Outside the town hall canteen, we meet Patrice Vergol. He showed us the skin condition he says makes it painful to wear the heavy clothes he needs as a motorbike courier. As a result, in July, he lost 70 euros to absence. He's not a fan of the new scheme. But what about the other staff?
There were two reactions. Majority think that it's a good idea. Minority think that it's not a good solution because if we are sick, it's not our fault.
Jean-Christophe Julie is Director of Human Resources. I asked him how it was legal to penalise workers for being sick.
It's legal.
Do you think the problem now, though, is that you've basically said to people, you can have 8 sick days a year and that's fine?
It was in the negotiation with the syndicates. They asked for 10 days or 15 days, but it was too much. And so we find 8 days.
Public officials are widely seen in France as enjoying a cushy set of benefits and job security most can only dream of. So we've come down to the bus stop just outside the town hall to see what taxpayers here in Bondy think of the new idea.
If they're ill, it penalises them. Aren't we allowed to be ill anymore? It's very harsh.
It could be a good thing, but normally you're here to work and do the work correctly. You have a salary, you work. It's a shame that we've had to come to this.
France's socialist government has been nagging away at the need to reform the economy, but the signs are perhaps clearest here in Bondy that France's traditional contract with its people is changing.
That was my colleague at the BBC, Lucy Williamson, reporting there from France. Now, in Sweden, there's also talk of reforms in the workplace, but at least in one city, they're going in the opposite direction. In Gothenburg, they're trying out a 30-hour work week. You could call it the six-hour-a-day experiment. Pia Webb is a quality-of-life career coach in Stockholm. Gothenburg is getting a lot of attention for shortening the work week there, Pia. What do you think about that?
Yes, I mean, For me, my first reflection on the 6 hours is, what will we do with the rest of the time? Of course, it's better to work less hours if you can manage your time, the other hours, to make sure that you get the time to recharge your batteries and really spend time on what's important for you in your life.
Can a person get as much accomplished in 6 hours as 8? I mean, doesn't the quality of the work suffer?
I don't think, to be fair, anyone could be efficient for 8 hours. And I mean, I know there's a lot of research done that 6 hours is what people tend to be efficient for. For example, if I work just a couple of hours in a day and I'm very, very focused on what my goal is for the day and I'm planned and I switch off the phone when I'm doing important work so I don't get distracted and so on, then I will be very efficient that day and I don't need to work that many hours.
But generally, you support the idea of a shorter work week.
Well, I do. Obviously, it's better to work fewer hours and to be efficient than to drag the whole day and be inefficient and work maybe 10, 12 hours.
In Gothenburg, the experiment for this 6-hour workday, I hear, has focused on senior homes where the nurses and assistants probably could use a shorter day. But is this a reality that all workers can actually be part of?
Well, at the moment, I don't know any of my colleagues that works 6 hours a day. So it's very, very limited amount of people that are actually trying this out.
It's late in the day there in Sweden. You're working hard because I think we've kept you up to talk with us. So you're on freelance overtime now. Generally, though, how many hours a week do you try to work?
Yeah, well, since our daughter died 9.5 years ago, that's the reason why I do work with quality of life, because I reflected on what life is all about. Mm. I reduced my hours and I work about 75% out of 40 hours. And I tend to be very efficient when I do work. And then I switch work off, apart from tonight then, which is for me, obviously, it's a private passion as well. So what's important for me is to recharge my batteries. And I find ways that work for me. I go to the sauna 3-4 hours a week. And I also put myself first, which is quite unusual.
This is not really on the same topic, but in a way it is. I mean, you know about this refugee crisis in Europe. Do you think with the arrivals coming into Sweden that thinking about yourself, looking after number one, is something you'll be able to continue doing when there are so many other societal pressures around you?
Well, when I mean looking after myself, it's important. I mean, it's easy for people to say, if I have a lot of issues that I don't deal with, it's very easy for me to spend my time helping other people rather than dealing with my own issues. And I think it's important that if I try to become a strong person so I can look after myself, I will have more time to do voluntary work, to do things for other people, to be there and support other people. So if everyone started to look after themselves, and it's very, very simple ways you can do this, you know, the world would be a better place.
Pia Webb, a quality of life and career coach in Stockholm. Thanks for this perspective. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Reporter Kim Gattis grew up in Lebanon during its civil war, and today she's annoyed by a question she hears all the time about Syrian war refugees.
Why are these people leaving? They have iPhones. They're well-dressed. They're not fleeing necessarily poverty or hunger. They're fleeing because they want to stay alive.
Rethinking Refugees, coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI and Soundworks.org, a collection of podcasts from PRI with global voices and perspectives, including Whose Century Is It? From The World's Mary Kay Magstad. Explore and subscribe at Soundworks.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We're going to spend the next few minutes of the show talking about people on the move, both in Europe and here in the United States. We begin in Europe and the ongoing migrant crisis there. Winter weather is making an already difficult journey even more treacherous. For many of the hundreds of thousands of migrants and refugees trying to reach Europe, aid groups are scrambling to respond. But at one crossing in Macedonia, it's the country's Muslim Albanian population that's been the first to respond. Susanna George has our story.
It was 2 months ago when Triton Malici first began to keep a pillow and a blanket in the back seat of his car. That's when it began to get too cold to sleep outside.
It was summer here. Sometimes we slept in tents. Sometimes we stayed till morning. In the morning we went home.
Tritan now calls his car his office. From here he makes calls, holds meetings, eats, and sleeps.
Just we don't have bathroom for shower, but...
But you will survive.
But there are some wet wipes, you know, you can...
Before hundreds of thousands of refugees and migrants began streaming through Macedonia, seeking safety and stability in Europe, Tritan was studying political science. He spent his nights and weekends at home with his wife and young daughter. Now, he's only home a few times a week to grab a change of clothes or a nap. He spends most of his time here, at a train station along Macedonia's border with Serbia, where thousands of refugees and migrants are dropped off every day to cross on foot. The scenes are chaotic. As people climb down from overpacked trains, there's no government presence, and just a handful of aid workers. Most of the people here are volunteers, and almost all of the volunteers are from Macedonia's Albanian Muslim community. Macedonia is one of the poorest countries that people will pass through as they travel up to the heart of the European Union.
Oh my God, when I come the first time here, I'm going mad. Because, you know, it's dangerous.
Zika Zaciri is one of the volunteers from a local mosque. He's talking about the 5-kilometer walk into Serbia along a dirt path that's pitch black at night.
Every 500 meters, I have people with a light. We're going down there.
He and his friends hold flashlights along the route to help guide families across the border.
The border here in Macedonia, over there is Serbia.
And now more and more they're handing out blankets, hats, and gloves. It's getting cold and few people are prepared. Tritan says he worries about the winter. Not only are the needs growing, but donations are starting to drop off.
Yes, always. Yes, I'm thinking about that. They are just with some of them with t-shirts, we give some clothes, but that's nothing. And imagine here it's warm, when we go outside from the train, they are shaking you so.
After the rush, Tritan and Mara Bajkovska, who served in the Macedonian military in Afghanistan, are settling back into their car for one of the more tedious parts of their job, waiting for the next train.
Tritan, where is the train?
Yeah, maybe it won't arrive.
I will call the railway, guys. 15, 20 minutes.
20 minutes, like 20 seconds.
Or like 2 hours.
Yes.
Tritan explains that one of the reasons Macedonia's Albanian community has stepped up to help refugees and migrants is because for them, being forced out of your home by violence isn't a foreign concept. It's a recent memory.
Today they are refugees, but maybe tomorrow we are. I as Albanian, 2 times we were refugees. No, people just wanted to leave and to go. Just to escape, because we were afraid of what is happening.
But he says the work he's doing here comes more from a humanitarian impulse than from religious kinship with Muslim refugees. And Mara isn't even Muslim. She just wanted to help. She says she's never even been inside a mosque before the crisis. But they both describe what they do as an intense calling, almost an obsession.
You cannot describe the feeling when you help people.
Mara admits it's almost addictive. Often she'll leave after the first evening train to go home, but only get so far before a text message or a phone call pulls her back. By 2 a.m., almost all of the big humanitarian groups have gone for the day. The only people left are volunteers from local mosques. The next train is set to arrive just before 3 a.m. In the back of Tritan's car is a set of textbooks from his PhD program. The next semester begins in January, but Tritan says that's also when the weather here will be at its worst. And as things stand now, he says he can't imagine returning to school. For The World, I'm Susanna George in Tabunice, Macedonia.
More than 2 million. That's the number of Syrian refugees already in Turkey. It's a staggering figure, but it doesn't offer much insight into how gut-wrenching that decision is to pack up and leave home. My BBC colleague Kim Gattas writes about this in Foreign Policy magazine. The war in Syria, Kim, the flight of refugees, I know it brings back memories from your own childhood. You lived in Beirut. The Lebanese Civil War at the time was at full tilt. You were young. You lived through it. What do you remember from those days?
Oddly enough, I remember, of course, the chaos, but the violence around us, the uncertainty. But I also remember that it felt very normal to me because it was really all that I had ever known. I was born 2 years into the war, and I was 13 when it ended. I remember the trips to school, not knowing whether we would actually make it. I remember the drives across this big intersection next to our house. We lived on the front line, right smack on the separation line between East and West Beirut. And I remember that we had to drive through this intersection. And it was famous, or infamous rather, for all the snipers that were located there. We'd wake up in the morning after a heavy night of shelling, having to make a decision about whether today was the day that we would go to school or stay at home. When we got used to the shelling, we stopped sometimes going down to the underground shelter, and we'd bring our mattresses to an inner hallway in the house, in the apartment that we lived on the third floor of a building, because we felt it was one of the safest areas. But, you know, you get used to it, and it is very odd. I don't miss it, but it also feels very familiar. And it was my childhood. And so sometimes I tell people that the strangest thing, the most unsettling thing about my memories of the Civil War is how familiar that feeling of being in a war actually is.
Yeah, so I would say, and I think a lot of people would say, that when living in a war zone starts to feel normal, that's maybe the time you ought to check out and maybe leave the country. Why did your parents, your family, decide not to leave Beirut?
It's a question I get often. I've never really quite had the full discussion with my parents about why we never left. I certainly don't blame them. You know, living in war is not something to be grateful for, but it made me who I am. And, you know, I think I've done all right. And growing up in Lebanon is what made me want to become a journalist. And I'm grateful for the choice that I made. And why we never left Lebanon is because it is a very difficult choice to make, to just leave everything you have ever known, everything that defines who you are, behind and start from scratch somewhere else as a refugee. You lose your identity, you lose who you are, you lose your sense of comfort, of home. You lose hope, perhaps, of ever coming back. And that is not a decision that people make lightly.
Speak from your own life living through the war in Beirut, Kim. I mean, for people who have not lived through war on their soil, like Americans, what is the U.S. getting wrong about Syria, do you think?
It's not so much about what is it getting wrong about Syria specifically, but I think that Europeans and Americans who have not had war on their soil for decades and, you know, centuries, in the U.S. specifically, are unable to empathize with people who are going through war, are unable to understand how conflict changes you forever, and are unable to understand why people are fleeing when they look like they're reasonably well-fed and well-dressed and have iPhones. That is the most jarring comment I have seen coming from people in Europe and in the U.S. Why are these people leaving? They have iPhones. They're well-dressed. They're not fleeing necessarily poverty or hunger, although there is that as well. They're fleeing because they want to stay alive, because they don't want to be forced into a rebel group and carry a gun. They don't want to be forced into the Syrian army. They're trying to make sure that their children get an education. That's the main reason that most people will cite when you ask them, why are you leaving? And a lot of them are hoping that one day they'll be able to come back and rebuild the country. And that's why I wanted to write this piece, because, you know, this isn't happening to people that Americans or Europeans have nothing in common with. This is happening to people who are like me, and I'm a Washington BBC correspondent writing for Foreign Policy magazine. So this isn't some distant war that you can't relate to.
Kim Gattas has long been a friend of ours here at The World. She wrote about her own experience of growing up during wartime in Lebanon for Foreign Policy. Kim, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Marco.
Now for a story about immigrants here in the U.S. Suppose you're new to this country. There are things you need to pick up fast: getting a job, learning English, navigating the school system. But then there are things that are not so obvious. The World's Monica Campbell has this report from Columbus, Ohio.
A Kroger supermarket in Columbus. There's a pharmacy here, too. Prescriptions get filled, refilled, normal stuff. What's unexpected happens in the break room upstairs.
All right, hi, everyone. Thank you for attending our presentation.
It's a class on navigating something that seems basic, the pharmacy. But it's all new for the people here, about 8 refugees from Bhutan. Many of them fled their homeland years ago. There was ethnic cleansing and went to refugee camps next door in Nepal. Now, many are arriving here in Columbus. Makes sense. Rent's cheaper here than other cities in the U.S. There's jobs and resettlement agencies. The community offers support, but there are blind spots, like the pharmacy. Back in the refugee camps, healthcare was rudimentary. Pharmacy students at Ohio State spotted a gap and created this class.
I'm going to go over the prescription label.
The label is complicated if you don't know English. There's info about refills, dosages, expiration dates. The refugees are also asked if they take any herbal medicine. Santa Bahadur, who arrived just 3 weeks ago, mentions a particular plant. It's a medicinal plant, he says, that people bring from Nepal and prepare at home. The students tell the group to let their doctor know things like this in case it creates complications with other medicines. There are also practical tips, like how to open a childproof cap. Press down, twist counterclockwise. Everyone practices opening a few. Helen Kim helped start the program. She's a researcher at Ohio State's pharmacy school and emigrated from South Korea with her family.
Myself and my parents went through pretty much the same thing. We as an immigrant or somebody who is newly resettled just do not know how to navigate, period.
There's also the risk that if people feel unsure how pharmacies work and don't get their medication or don't take it right, they can end up sick, unable to work and provide for their families. The day ends heading downstairs to the pharmacy itself.
It's like the exciting part of the whole presentation.
They go over the pickup, drop-off windows, and the aisles filled with meds. Then comes everyone's favorite part, the blood pressure machine. Nobody knew what it was. Santa Bahadur takes a crack at it.
Welcome to the Higgy Station. Are you a guy or a gal?
Boy.
Turn your palm to the sky, relax, and breathe normally.
The cuff inflates.
Here are your results.
And watching all this is Ben Michaels, the pharmacist here. He says the class makes his job easier.
I might see these people walking around, but I would have no idea what their stories were or where they came from or even what language they spoke.
This Kroger's also now subscribes to an over-the-phone medical translation service.
It's actually extremely quick, even for Nepali, which is not as common as Spanish or French. Nepali we can normally get under a minute and a half, start to finish.
It's an investment, but the store manager says it's worth it. Customers become loyal, and there are no errors because of cultural barriers. And I ask Santa Bahadur what this class means to him. He says it gives him confidence he needed just the other day when his son was homesick with a cough.
My son is suffering from a cough.
He had a cough.
A week ago. So at that time, I want to come here, but I don't know where the pharmacy is.
From today?
From today. Alone, I can come here and to buy medicine. It is great opportunity. It is a great occasion for me.
For the world, I'm Monica Campbell, Columbus, Ohio.
Tomorrow, a student in Ciudad Juarez who goes to school each day with something most American students don't need, a passport. Every day she crosses the border to attend school in the United States. Her story tomorrow on The World. And coming up in about a minute, W.C. Fields had some choice words about drinking water and what fish do in it. I guess he never knew about Guinness Stout. That's next on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Guinness, we're told by the brewery, is good for you, but what about fish guts? Are they good for you too? Because it turns out that fish guts are a key part of making Guinness. I didn't know that, but apparently a lot of vegans do. The guts in question are actually fish bladders. They're made into a type of gelatin called isinglass, and that's used to help make the dark stout. But the company says not for long. Guinness has announced that all beer brewed at its St. James Gate Brewery in Dublin will no longer be made with isinglass. The World's Bradley Campbell has more.
Fish guts. I mean, really? It's kind of gross. But that got me thinking. Why was this stuff called isinglass even used in the first place? And to answer that, I went to Sean Lewis. He's the author of We Make Beer and our go-to guy for all things brewed here at The World.
Basically, it is used to clarify the beer. You use it at the end of fermentation to sort of grab on to extra yeast and protein particles that might be floating in the beer, and it brings it all to the bottom.
That stuff gets drawn out before the beer gets shipped. Now, Lewis says Guinness has been using isinglass since the 19th century. It's actually a traditional ingredient in making beer. But Lewis says few outside the brewing industry really know about it. So if it's common and you're vegan, should you be worried about other beers? Well, yes and no.
It's a common practice, especially in the UK. It's a traditional practice. But I don't think many people are too concerned about it. I don't think anybody should be concerned about it. It effectively doesn't ever make it into the bottle or your glass. So yeah, I don't think it was very common knowledge, but it's been a very common practice for a long time.
Now, if it's this old school practice and it rarely ends up in the beer, why should Guinness even change it?
I think the big reason is to make them vegan friendly. I think that's been sort of a new trend in food in general, and it's been a concern. There was an article published not too long ago, a year or so ago, that talked about various chemicals and stuff in beer, and a lot of it was kind of silly and fear-mongering of sorts, but it did mention isinglass, and it did turn a lot of people off of Guinness to think that there might be fish parts in their beer.
Guinness has breweries all over the world making their stout for local consumption. Lewis says it looks like each facility will eventually change their methods and free themselves of the fish guts. Guinness will not share what they are replacing it with. That's a secret. The big question many fans of Guinness are asking, though, is this. Will it change the taste?
You know, anytime you alter things, especially to do with the how we remove yeast or filter, it has the possibility of changing the taste. But my guess is with Guinness, they're a very large-scale brewer with a very sophisticated lab technology. They're going to make sure that the beer tastes the same in the end, whether that means adding, you know, slightly more roasted barley or a little bit more hops, whatever it may take to get that same flavor. I don't think the taste of Guinness is going to change at all.
And it's not going to stop you from drinking it?
No, absolutely not. No, in fact, the only thing I can imagine is that more vegans are going to be willing to accept Guinness now than they were before.
More vegans. You hear that, Portland, Oregon? I think it's time for a round. For The World, I'm Bradley Campbell.
Want a pastrami taco to go with that vegan Guinness? Probably not. Definitely not if you're vegan. But if you did want a pastrami taco, Alex Stupak has you covered. He's a chef and owner of Empeon Cocina in New York City. It's a Mexican restaurant with many twists. And that makes sense when you know that Stupak made his name as a pastry chef who loved to play with science in the kitchen.
You take a dish of strawberries and the strawberries disappear because they're manipulated in so many different textures. If you think of like the modern art world and it became more about the act of doing it rather than the result, that's what this was as well. It was very much about shock or novelty or really trying to provoke and change the way people thought. And while I was working for these kings of this type of cooking, I was in my spare time thinking, well, what am I going to do when I have my own restaurant? When things are provocative and new, after a while, they catch on and they become mainstream. You know, so for me, it was time to move on. I began eating a lot of Mexican cuisine in my spare time. I fell in love with a Mexican girl from LA, and we moved in together, and she was cooking it for me. And the turning point for me, it was actually very simple. I had a tortilla. It was the first time I had ever had a tortilla where someone took fresh masa made from corn and pressed it out by hand and put it on a hot griddle and served it to me immediately. This was a restaurant in Los Angeles called La Paria in 2008. The restaurant is decorated in this crazy psychedelic way that only Mexican restaurants could be decorated in. There's colors that you didn't know existed, juxtaposed in ways that you couldn't imagine. There are paper streamers, there's folk art. It looks like 15 different quinceañeras happened there at one time. And I don't know how to describe it. You hear Americans say, like, well, I prefer flour tortillas. It's because they've never had a good corn tortilla. The corn tortillas that we're used to having, we buy them in a grocery store. They're mealy. They're sort of crumbly. These were not that way. They were soft. They were supple. They were dense. They had an intangible but very present corn aroma about them. And once I had one, I wanted to wrap everything you could possibly eat in a tortilla. As crazy as it was, I just decided that I was going to write a business plan for a Mexican restaurant. There are many people who have been documenting and codifying this cuisine who feel like it's not to be played with, it's not to be fooled around with. I've always found that ironic because the cuisine itself as we know it today is a result of indigenous fusion. So the experimentation revolves around where do you draw the line? So could Mexican cooking keep its integrity yet absorb another culture? Can it absorb things that are inherent to New York City cuisine, pastrami, something like this? I would like to see Mexican cooking become that radical. And not even for a second would anyone think that it's losing its own identity. It's actually imparting its identity onto other things. You will have people eat in your restaurant and go, I get what you're trying to do. You'll also get responses like, this is not how this is done. I get it. And at the end of the day, and it sounds odd, people want a restaurant, they want it to be beloved unanimously. But I've kind of made the decision in my career that I would always rather be provocative than homogenous and just uniformly loved. So I know this sounds weird, but I actually think we're successful because we're divisive.
That was Alex Tupac of New York City's Empellón Cocina. He told his story to producer Alex Galifant. And that'll do it for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship. More information is available at skoll.org. The PRI Ambassador Council, including Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation, and the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security at carnegie.org. And by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.